You are listening to Written in the Stars, Books and Beyond, where hosts from the LCC Library sit down with writers, publishers, entrepreneurs, and literary enthusiasts of all types. Join us as we explore the very heart of the written word.
Welcome to Written in the Stars, Books and Beyond. I'm John Saleji. Beside me is my co-host, Robin Moore.
Hello.
Today we are talking about the 2026 Michigan Notable Books. We are joined by Adam Oster and Mindy Babarskis from the Library of Michigan. Adam is the community engagement librarian. Mindy is a reference librarian and helps coordinate the Michigan Notable Books program. Welcome back,
Thank you, Adam
and Mindy.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
So glad to meet you all. Well, yep. See you again, Mindy, yes. And meet you, Adam. All righty.
First question, the name Michigan Notable Books is pretty self-explanatory.
Yes.
But what qualifies a book to be considered for Michigan Notable Books?
That's a great question. So to be considered for a Michigan Notable Book, it needs to either be written by a Michigan author or about Michigan or the Great Lakes. And sometimes it'll be a combination of those two. And then it also needs to be published in the year before we honor it. So. Oh. Or I should say copyrighted in the year before it's honored. So this year it says the 2026 Michigan Notable Books. Mm-hmm. All of those books are 2025 copyright.
Okay.
Yeah. So those are kind of the main things. There's some things that we're looking for, like, you know, quality, making sure it's not a second edition. So, you know, we want to make sure this is the first time this is coming out, because reissues, those can be honored in other ways too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It's good to know.
Are there any requirements for subject matter or what kind of book it is or anything like that?
No, all genres.
Yeah, it can run the gamut. We can have fiction, nonfiction, poetry, memoirs.
Children's books.
Yeah, children's books, you know, illustrated or juvenile fiction. It can run the gamut. And I think just something about just the program and the books that we receive is you never know what's going to come. Mm-hmm. You know, some years it might be heavy with more memoirs, or other years it might be a bit more creative writing or nonfiction.
Fiction. Yeah.
I think that's one of the really great things about the program itself, is that, like, you never know what's going to come each year. Mm-hmm. And it puts people on the spot, like Mindy, who are on the committee. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot to go through, because you're talking anywhere from 300 to more.
It's usually around 300. I would say. And, you know, we're always trying to, like, we're seeking out books. If we hear about a book that's about Michigan or by a Michigan author, I'll, like, go up, reach out to the publisher and try to get copies. You know, I'm sending stuff out to publishers saying, send us what you got. Yeah. You know, I'm really trying to cast as wide of a net as possible. You know, so that means self-published. That means from a big publisher. That means, you know, a Michigan press. It's really trying to get that coverage of Michigan authors.
I love that.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, can people nominate books, or can...
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Okay.
Yeah. So reach out to us.
Oh, don't worry.
Yeah. Because I rely on that. Frankly, it's like, you know, there's no way one person can keep track of that all. So I need that, like, network of people looking out and saying, oh, I saw this book, and sending it to me. So
I got you. Yeah. I got you.
Is there like a form or an email address on the website?
With the Michigan Notable Books website, there's michigan-notable-books@michigan.gov. That's the email. That's the shared email account. So multiple people look at that, and we're looking for submissions and different things. Okay. But if you forget that, if that's too many words, also librarian@michigan.gov works too.
All righty. So Michigan Notable Books includes several events. Tell us about the different events that make up this program.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's cool. It's a year-long program. Mm-hmm. So we have the book tour, so the author tour, and any of the authors from the list who can participate, we send them to libraries across the state. Mm-hmm. And this year we extended the time frame. So instead of being April through June, which it used to be in the past, it's now April through August that these tours are going on. So actually this week we're going to be publishing the list of author tour stops, like probably tomorrow-ish.
Tomorrow or Saturday. As soon as Mindy gets me the list, I'll put it on the website.
Yeah, exactly. I had to wrangle a few dates from libraries today. So And that's going to be in the Upper Peninsula to Detroit. I mean, all over the state.
Yeah, there's 50 locations. And something that we also added into it, too, just a few years ago, is that we also added what we call virtual authors conversations. So if you aren't able to make it to any of the events, you still can look for, and we film these typically towards the later end of the summer, early fall, so that people can hear. Typically, they run about a half hour to 45 minutes conversation between either, you know, one of us that work at the Library of Michigan or some of the people that are on the committee that will interview some of the authors. And it's that kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
If we were pulling out our old DVDs, it'd be those.
Oh, fun.
That type of thing that you'd find on there.
Little commentary, yes.
Yeah.
And those are a lot of fun.
Yeah.
They really are.
You learn more about, I think, aspects of the authors. Books and the writing style that maybe just don't come up during the regular events that they're participating in.
Yeah, it's more about them as the author and their writing process than it is about necessarily plot points in the book.
Yeah.
So it's a fun, like a different angle to the whole story.
Yeah, so the author tour, I'm really intrigued by that. So so you go to different libraries or different just spaces and just are you on a bus? Can people go with you, or what does this look like?
So it's not actually us. Yeah. It's,
what we do is that we will put out an application form early on once the books and titles have been announced. Okay. Mindy's very good at wrangling the authors so that we can determine which ones of them will be available to be on the tour. But any library in Michigan can apply. Schools can apply. We've also encouraged other places like bookstores and museums, but it's predominantly libraries. Especially we're trying to get authors into areas that, you know, maybe they don't necessarily have the ability to bring in authors of this caliber.
Yeah.
It could be a small township library that's in rural Tuscola County or somewhere up in, you know, Dickinson, Ironwood area up in the UP.
Not familiar, but okay.
Just go up to the UP and head straight west and you'll run in Ironwood.
Yes, it's there.
Okay. They actually have a visit this year, too.
Yes.
Nice. And so then that library would then work with the author to find a time that works within that time frame. Mm-hmm. And all we do is, well, the Library of Michigan Foundation, thank you, nonprofit that supports us, they will then cut the check to the authors and say, okay, you're doing four visits. Here's the check for those four visits. And they get a certain amount for each visit. And so it's also nice, too, because some authors can really only do one visit. Some are like, send me anywhere and I'll do five. So shout out to Carlos Fuentes, who did the vacation. He's doing, I think, five visits, all over the state. So, you know, some of them are like, send me everywhere.
Love that. What
so
a great opportunity.
Can you, since you brought up the vacation, can you tell us a little bit more about that book and kind of why you wanted to add it to this year's list?
Yeah, it was. So when we talk about Michigan notable books, like, we are very intentional about the word notable.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is it's unique. It's something that really just speaks to Michigan and the people, or it's just, you know, the story is just so engaging. So there's different reasons where it might be notable. Really what we found with the vacation was there really hasn't been anything written about a teenage migrant worker's experience in the cherry orchards of Traverse City from this kind of perspective, where it's written, it's him retelling his experience as a teenager. And it's just so tender, but it's done in a way that it's like, it feels like you're reading his diary. So it's something that a youth could read, that they would connect with, but it's also something that adults could read to really get that, oh, I remember, you know, being a teenager and that sort of coming of age, but also understanding this experience. And it's just, it's such a tender story. And it's his personal life story. He has some pictures of his family and their experiences. And I mean, I think it's just such a unique experience, too, of this teenage migrant worker experience. But he's coming from it was not something that they did every summer. This was, they did this once, you know, a couple summers. It wasn't like this was their life all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he's also got this insider-outsider perspective at the same time. And he's just a lovely person.
Aww.
He'll bring you cherries.
I love that.
I know, right?
I can't wait to. I want to read that book, John. I'm going to tell you why. Because I visited Traverse City for the first time last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never been there before. So you just speaking about it, I'm just intrigued to get this book and to read it because I thought it was a beautiful little touch.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
I think that's also becoming a I don't want to call it a fad, but like an opportunity that people have, especially with a lot of the books on the notable books list, because you can read about these places and most of the locations are relatively close that you can get to. Then if you read about something that's going on in Detroit, it's not that far away to get to something that's in West Michigan. Yeah, the Upper Peninsula is a little ways away, but like once you get across the bridge. Yeah.
Road trip.
I know. Right?
Well, and it's amazing too, talking about Traverse City.
Yeah.
You know, you get to hear about it from this really like sweet perspective coming of age story. But then now you also have This Magnetic North, which is another book on the list. Mm. And he's talking about some of the challenges that Traverse City specifically, or that region, and the North is really facing with having you, because it's so beautiful and people are just drawn to this area. You're now having issues with what we would call gentrification when it comes to an urban area.
Yeah.
Same issue. People are being priced out by people who are vacationing there for
tourists.
Tourists.
Yeah.
So it's like the people who live there full year round are like, we can't afford to live here.
Yes.
We can't, the traffic is terrible. Like the infrastructure wasn't built for this. And like just today I was reading an article in Bridge, Michigan that they were looking at what counties you saw growth. And a lot of it was West Michigan around Traverse City. It's exploding.
Yeah.
And in northern Michigan, and you know, it's a great thing. They're like, we want people to come here. We want people to see this beautiful place. But is there a way that we can do this responsibly that people can afford to live?
Yes.
So fascinating too.
So I guess one other kind of serious thing this past year when it came to the Library of Michigan is our state librarian Randy Riley passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he was really instrumental in at least growing the Michigan Notable Books program. So could you tell us a little bit about like what Randy's role and kind of legacy was especially when it comes to this program?
I think the best summation in an answer for that is this program would not be what it is without Randy Riley.
Mm-hmm.
He was somebody who I've seen multiple interactions with him with authors. He always, you know, would take the time to meet with every author.
Mm-hmm.
He tried as much as what he could to go to events whether it was, you know, somebody who was currently on the tour or if there was anybody else who was on a past Michigan Notable Book honoree. He lived and breathed the Michigan Notable Books program.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's so much else beyond him just with his time both as state librarian and his previous positions that he had at the Library of Michigan. He was there for almost 37 years.
Wow.
Yeah,
and
that's a long time.
Like that, it just, you know, there's very few people that have been able to inhabit that at our institution.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be very much missing his presence, but at the same time, be honoring his legacy and time as part of it. So, I mean, I know, John, you probably interacted with him a few times.
Yes,
there.
Yes, I've had the opportunity to meet him on many occasions.
Yes.
So,
such a warm personality. You know, if you wanted anybody to be able to be your state librarian, it was Randy Riley.
Wow.
And I know another thing that Randy did a lot of and really kind of pride himself in was going to all of the libraries in Michigan, you know, trying to get to all of the libraries in Michigan. And, you know, you've already talked kind of about the tour, but I feel like the tour is kind of representative of that too. I know Randy would try to go to like small libraries whenever he was anywhere, you know, and I do see that kind of in the tour as well. And so,
I'm pretty sure that the tour became the thing that it is because Randy said, we're going to do this.
Mm. Yes.
You know?
Yes. Well, and even just in general that us at the Library of Michigan, try our best to make it to libraries all over. And I think one of the more favorite ones, stories that I've heard of Randy, it wasn't for Notable Books, but it was for a small library in Breckenridge that wasn't even, what they were doing is that they were opening up a new community room and they were having a ribbon cutting. And there is a picture of Randy there with the big scissors cutting it open and you know, the crowd there. And Breckenridge is very small. It's this little rural area in Gratiot County. Mm-hmm. And you know, he went there to do it. And one of the more recent ones he did was when Curtis Township became their own library system. And he wasn't there just for a day. There was Randy Riley, like, almost week, because they had coffee with your state librarian. And there was a sign that had "Welcome State Librarian Randy Riley" with glitter on it. When he came, you know, and Randy was always that sort of, like, shucks kind of guy a little bit with it. And when we heard about the glitter, we were like, okay, yeah, now we know why you're going out.
So what are your hopes and dreams for the program in the future?
Yes, I mean, there's so much. The tour, I think, is really the cornerstone mm-hmm. of this program. Like, you know, Night for Notables is great to be able to celebrate and to really support the Library of Michigan Foundation as well in that. But for me, that tour is really, I would love to be able to grow it in many other ways, you know, whether it's like we could also have some virtual mm-hmm. or, you know, be able to have more than 50. I mean, at this moment, though, it is kind of buck stops with me. So it's we're kind of stuck at where we're at right now. Yeah. But, you know, to be able to provide some more funding to authors, because for some of them, they really just can't make it work, you mm-hmm. know, they with the travel. So if I would be able to give them a higher honorarium, that would be great, because then that could allow for some of those who are coming out from Montana yeah. or, you know, to stay for a week and to really be able to go to all these libraries or to come out for the Night for Notables and then also come out for the tour. So, I, you know, I think that's one piece of it.
Well, I think another part of it, too, is that, you know, we get back to how the tour is a way to bring authors to places that normally don't have them mm-hmm. and that I hope that, you know, we're in somewhere, whether it's, you know, Hancock or Tawas or some of these places that are in Michigan, that there is somebody who is thinking of becoming a writer mm-hmm. or that they've been researching a topic for a long time, and that when they go to one of these events that they get inspired by it, and that it says to them that, oh yeah, I can get this down and get this published in some way, and that next generation of writers is creating works that us decades down the line are going to be reading, be like, yep, that's a notable, that's got to go on the list.
Right.
And we're lucky enough that our state is so full of it's that palette of topics and talent.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're lucky with musicians, it's like that, and we're lucky with authors that it doesn't matter where you go, you can find something to write about and somebody out there to tell that story.
Mm. Yeah. And I think also just getting the word out there about Michigan Notable Books so that people are more aware of these amazing Michigan stories and Michigan authors.
Because
mm-hmm. I think a lot of times, you know, we know about the big author from California and New York, but I mean, not many people know about the incredible authors and stories that are here set in Michigan, even yeah. in their own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to get the people in our state to know their own local stories, but also beyond that, to get national attention, right? To say, oh, hey, you know, that story that's set in New York is great and all, but have you read this story that's set in Lansing?
Right.
You know?
Right, yeah.
So remind us again how folks that might want to attend a stop on the tour, how can they learn about those things, and how can they, you know, attend events?
So the easiest place to learn anything about the Notable Books program, go to michigan.gov/notablebooks. That's where we have both the current list, previous year's lists on there, details about the program itself. For anybody who wants to learn more and ask questions, either call us at 517-335-1477 or email us at librarian@michigan.gov.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Alrighty.
Yeah. And thank you, Adam and Mindy, for talking with us today. It's been great to learn about this year's books and the program. So thank you very much for coming in.
Yeah, you guys are welcome.
Yep,
thank you.
We're excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. We're excited to have you. How about that?
I love it.
You have been listening to Written in the Stars, Books and Beyond. Visit lcc.edu/library to find the titles discussed in this episode. You can find previous episodes of Written in the Stars and other LCC Connect shows at lccconnect.com. And in the words of Miguel de Unamuno, I hope, reader, we shall meet again, and we shall recognize each other.
Sharing the voices of Lansing Community College. Visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices. Vibes. Vision.
Massage therapy can be an effective method to combat stress and anxiety. It can also be helpful for injury treatment and prevention. The Lansing Community College Massage Therapy Clinic is open to the public and provides the opportunity for students to learn. Visit lcc.edu/massage for more information.
Sportsmanship has never been more important between the lines in athletics and outside those lines in our communities. To listen, to respect, to understand, to practice common decency, to have competition without contentiousness. Sportsmanlike qualities are essential components of life itself. Let's all work together to not only be good sports, but good people. A message from the Michigan High School Athletic Association promoting the value and values of educational athletics.
Michigan residents age 25 or older may qualify for Michigan Reconnect, a program providing free or reduced tuition to students who have not earned a prior college degree. Reconnect students are responsible for books and fees. Visit lcc.edu/reconnect for more information.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Hello, and welcome to Leading the Way, Women in Higher Education, a podcast dedicated to celebrating, supporting, and advancing women in higher education across Michigan. Hello, I'm Dr. Cynthia Rooker, and I am so thrilled to welcome Dr. Shay James Boyd, Chair of Women of Color Collaborative, WOCC, Michigan ACE. Dr. Shay James Boyd will share WOCC's journey, its impact, and the work still ahead to ensure equity and advancement of women of color in academia. Good afternoon, Dr. Boyd. Would you please introduce yourself to our audience and tell us about your current role in higher education?
Well, good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me. I am Dr. Shay James Boyd. I am the Assistant Director of Institutional Advancement at Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan, and it's just my pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Now, could you please share with us a story behind the founding of WOCC and what inspired its creation?
Absolutely. WOCC really is kind of the brainchild of Dr. Lynette Finley, who back in 2011 really saw a need for women of color to have a space where they could come together and really just talk about the issues that really impacted them. So at the time, there were lots of isolation and marginalization and just really, as she put it, bullying and disrespect. And she wanted to come together with a group of women to find out, this is the profession that we love. How do we come together and find a way to just navigate those challenges across the campuses that these women are working on? And so they first said, well, let's just come together and let's collaborate and let's talk over food. And that led to the inception, really, of the first WOCC luncheon that was held at Eagle Crest Conference Center at Eastern Michigan University, and about 65 women came. And I think just to see that it was 65 women at that particular time who came together, there was definitely a need. And so out of that, WOCC was birthed, and it's been on a great trajectory since then.
Wow. And you, as we know, food will always bring people together, right? So that
always.
Yes.
Always.
Absolutely.
Food is always.
And
always good.
Yes. And she created that space for women to come together, women of color to come together. and to talk about some of those initial challenges. Can you share with us some of those challenges that are facing WOCC as far as what needed to be addressed at that time?
Well, it's interesting that you should say at that time, because quite frankly, those same issues are alive and well in 2026. Many women of color are often the first and many the only women serving at their levels of their institution. And so there's just the idea of having to work harder. And I know when I say this, you know, people will say, well, you know, all women have to work hard. And yes, we do. We're paid less than men across the board. However, when it comes to women of color, there's an extra, you know, they talk about the glass ceiling. It's more like a concrete ceiling. A glass ceiling, you can see through. Concrete, you can't see through it. You have to kind of chisel your way through to break through to see what's on the other side. And so for women of color, the issues that were alive and well in 2011, or I'd go back and even say, you know, in 2000, they're still here. Things such as the stereotypes, the microaggressions, the gaslighting, all of those things that come from women of color in positions. For a quick example, that she could be leading a whole department, but being second guessed. There's nothing like having a staff person go over your head to go somewhere else to get the same answer that you just gave them.
Ooh.
So the Women of Color Collaborative, you know, it gives you a space to, how do you navigate that with grace, with being an authority figure in the seat that you sit in? So all of those things are still here. And we're not going to say that it doesn't happen for all women, because it does. But for women of color, it's just turned up a degree or two.
Okay, wow. So can you tell us a little bit how WOCC has evolved since its first luncheon, as you mentioned, back in 2011?
Absolutely. So since then, the luncheon really has evolved into this space where women from all over the state of Michigan will come together on an institution's campus. And again, the food is the connector, but the relationships that have been built over the course of the last several years, that's a time when you can actually come and see your colleagues in a space where, again, there's food, but there's also an inspirational word or panel or just activities that allow you to be able to, one, really understand that you're not alone. The things that you have been dealing with on your campus, you may have felt like that you were in isolation, but when you come to the luncheon, it's evolved to this space where it's electric. And the people who are there are so passionate about their, it's kind of a recommitment as well to helping one another. And it's a resurgence of, hey, you know what? I can do this. You know, I'm not alone. And it really just becomes a place where you're making your net work for you. So over the years, it's just evolved where it was 65 women. At our most recent WOCC luncheon this past November, we had upwards of 200 women. So it's gaining momentum, and the word is reaching out across the campuses who are members of MIACE that, hey, this is something you want to make sure is on your calendar each year.
Oh, absolutely. I remember that. I attended that, and I do remember it was electrical. It was unbelievable, the room, and they had to get more chairs because there were so many people they didn't expect.
They did.
It was, I mean, what a good problem to have, right?
An excellent problem.
Absolutely. Well, how about you share like a moment or a story that reflects the impact that WOCC has on women's, whether it's their career, the passion of the belonging that you talk about. Can you share something like that with us?
It's hard to just share one story. So I'll just share what it looks like for the women who participate in WOCC. First and foremost, it looks like professional advancement. I can think off the top of my head, my colleagues who were aspiring to be college presidents, to be chancellors, to be deans, and just to move up in their career. And they have actually done that. And I will say that Dr. Lynette Finley is still very, very engaged in the network and WOCC. And I think about one young lady who is now the executive director president of the University of Michigan Alumni Association. And I think about how Dr. Finley wrote a letter for her, how the network rallied around her, and she is now in that seat. And she is just one of many examples. My former co-chair, Dr. Stephanie Lee, she has just recently been promoted. So across the board, you can see how the professional advancement is that key piece that kind of pulls this group together, and then being able to celebrate them mm-hmm. is that sense of belonging. When we get together, there's nothing greater than just, you know, celebrating someone and giving them their flowers and stuff while they can smell them. And I mean that literally over a lunch, just to say, you know, you did it. You hung in there, you did it. So now that you're there, you're going to look back and you're going to help somebody else come along. So mm-hmm. that's just one of many examples. You can look across this board and there are lots of women who have benefited from being a member of WOCC and the MIACE network.
Great. I love how you use the, let me show you how it looks instead of sharing like a moment, because there, it sounds like there's just so many stories, but let me give you an example of what it looks like. I love that. That's great. Yeah. That's great. So tell us, how do member institutions collaborate? So to host an annual WOCC luncheon, and what makes each one of those luncheons, what makes it unique? What is it about the luncheon?
So, very interesting. The institutions really self-identify. So I have been a member for quite some time, probably a good 8 years ago. And actually, at the point where I decided, oh my goodness, I really want to do more for WOCC is when we held the luncheon at Henry Ford College. At Henry Ford College, right then, someone came up and said, hey, we want to host it next year. And that has been how it has happened. At every luncheon, because of the energy that's in the room, mm-hmm. people are just, they're like, look, we want this at our camp. We need this here over where we are. So much so that we are booked out to 2027 for institutions that are going to host the luncheon in November. And so we kind of have our brand, and of course that brand includes some food. It includes a powerful message or a panel, but something that's going to inspire the troops, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And there's always some kind of a networking activity. And really from there, the institutions, it's unique. Each institution or college, they bring their own flair to the luncheon. As the chair of WOCC, my job is really just to kind of guide them through. They really do, they take ownership, they put together their own committees, they get the gifts, they plan the, they keep the brand that we have of those key things that we'd like to have. But they will, you know, sometimes there's music, we've had dancing, they've taken us on tours, and while it was at Henry Ford College, I had it set up where you could go over to the Henry Ford Museum if you wanted to take the afternoon and kind of go over there. So everyone makes it their own, but they self-identify. How the luncheon happens each year and where it's going to be is totally random, and that's part of what makes it fun and interesting.
Well, that's great. It sounds like each institution will put their cultural touch onto that luncheon that boosts the energy and gets people engaged and excited about being together for just a short period of time, but like you said, yet keeping the brand but putting their own ownership type on there. That's great. Excellent. So what role does WOCC play in the Michigan ACE annual conference, and can you tell us how those sessions are tailored to the needs of women of color?
Sure. When we first started out, WOCC really coordinated the whole first day. You got the speakers, the sessions, everything that transpired the first day, WOCC had a hand in. But as the conference has evolved, so we have evolved. So now we still have a space there on the first day. We are instrumental in helping to select the speaker for the first day. And we also want to make sure that there are some sessions that are geared toward women of color to speak to their individual needs at the conference. And also, you know, we try to find time to just connect with one another in the evenings and whatnot. mm-hmm. on that first day.
Excellent. That sounds great. Then you're putting in, yeah, exactly some of the programming into your brand, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. What kind of professional development or networking opportunities does WOCC offer throughout the year?
Certainly. We typically meet monthly on a Friday morning at 8:30. And that time and that day is kind of just funny because we were trying to figure out when's the best time to meet. And that was the time when everyone decided, hey, either I'm kind of going into the office and I might be in my car and I can call in to the session, or I can jump on my Zoom before the day gets going. Friday, we found out, was the light day for most people. And so we meet at 8:30 before the day gets away from all of us. And we meet for an hour. And again, it's that space where we come together. We usually have a theme maybe that we'll talk on. We'll talk about any kind of business initiatives that MIACE is involved in that we want to make sure we carry forward. And then from there, you know, we're networking and celebrating with one another. That's one of the things we do. We also have a newsletter that comes out a couple of times during the academic year where we're also making sure we have member spotlights and things of that nature, and what kind of books are we reading, and just scholarships and just news and information that women of color can use to advance their career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other final thing that we definitely do is we hold webinars. That's one of the ways we kind of the tools we use that institutions who are not, mm-hmm. yes, they can stay connected, but if they're not members of MIACE, they can still kind of join in on one of the webinars that goes out across the state of Michigan.
Excellent.
So those are about the three things that we do throughout the course of the year.
Okay. Wow. Plenty of opportunities. That's great for networking. Excellent. Well, I've got one more question for you, and it's
sure.
It's about looking ahead. If you could just mm-hmm. share some of the WOCC goals for the future, and how can institutions better support women of color in higher education?
Well, certainly. So I will say that this is my last year as chair, so I will be officially rolling into another position later on this year. So I think I'm going to let the new chair really talk about what the future is. However, I can only see her taking it and making it even better, finding more ways and resources for women just to connect with the fresh eyes and just a fresh outlook.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that's in store. But we're certainly proud of all the accomplishments that we've made over the last, 4 years as I've been in this position. And institutions can certainly just support by making sure, first of all, you are a member of MIACE. And so let me just say that WOCC, we're not a separate organization. We're the affinity group that falls under MIACE, which is for all women in the state of Michigan. And so if they get in there, you'll be connected to everything we do. And if you want to find out and get totally connected right to us, get in touch. If you're listening and you're a member institution, get in touch with your institutional representative on your campus. And they can plug you in to all of the resources for MIACE, which we fall up underneath as one of their affinity groups.
Oh, excellent. That's great. Well, this is fantastic. It's been wonderful talking with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
For sharing.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So thank you for sharing the powerful story and ongoing work of Women of Color Collaborative. WOCC is more than a program under Michigan ACE. It's a movement that continues to break down barriers and build pathways for women of color in higher education. So if you're inspired by today's conversation, we encourage you to learn more, attend a WOCC event, or connect with your institution's institutional representative. So please visit connect.com for more episodes. Until next time, keep leading, keep learning, and keep lifting others along the way. Thanks for tuning in to Leading the Way, Women in Higher Education. To listen to this episode and others, visit lccconnect.com. Until next time, keep leading, keep learning, and keep lifting others along the way.
Keep connected with LCC Connect at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Every year, the Dental Hygiene Clinic at Lansing Community College provides essential services to people in the mid-Michigan community. Open to the public, the clinic is led by a licensed dental faculty and provides a platform for LCC dental students with the opportunity to hone their dental hygiene skills. Associated fees apply to clinic services. To find more information, visit lcc.edu/dentalclinic.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. She wasn't even really sure where she was at.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it. I felt so much better after my son told me, "Mom, we'll figure it out."
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
The Lansing Community College Foundation provides scholarships that make education possible, change students' lives, and uplift our community. Students may apply for scholarships November 1st through January 31st. Learn more at lcc.edu/scholarships.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Welcome to a psycho-delicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from two local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, DNP, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond. Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
I'm Mike Stratton.
And I'm Morgan Bowen.
And we are here to talk about shame. This is part two.
I'm Dedalian.
And Dedalian is our producer.
Producer.
We're a little goofy.
Right now, we're rolling season two. Yeah.
Season two.
Yeah.
If you haven't listened to season one, or well,
listen to
you have a lot of catching up to do.
You do.
And if you haven't listened to part one of Shame, this might not make sense. So go back and listen to part one of Shame. This is part two. This
I think Shame makes sense to everybody.
Yeah, to understand some of the manifestations of it, some of how it comes about, all that kind of stuff is stuff that we explored in the first chunk. Mm-hmm. But we could have done it.
And how to deal with it and process it.
Well, that's this part.
That's what we're doing now.
That's what
we kind of hinted a little bit.
Yeah, but now we have to get into it. How do you deal with it? How do you deal with it?
Oh, you got to bring it to light in my mind, you know. So I remember, you know, so coming out, I was 16, you know, was I 15? 15 or 16. And, you know, I thought being gay was going to be something that I was going to hide forever. I had to hide it forever and ever and ever. And I just kind of just thought that was the way it had to be. And when I came out, it just was this enormous. It was terrifying. It was not a great experience, I guess, but I just remember the relief. Yeah. The relief made it so worth it immediately. It was like, whatever happens from here, at least I am not. I mean, I just felt like free in a way.
Did people respond differently than you thought they would?
Interesting. Well, it was kind of a stage thing. It wasn't like I came out, you know, to everybody. So mm-hmm. My parents were actually the first people to know. And of course, they always knew, but so they were, you know, I've talked about this before. I mean, they were fairly support, I would say moderately supportive. This was the 90s. They were very baby boomer about it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, we love you. We will always love you, but this is a hard life. This is, you know, this is not a people in this population are marginalized and you will be at the recesses or the edges of society. And I said, that's cool.
I mean, would you agree though that they made it sound a little more disparaging than
yes,
it really is?
Yeah. I think that they did. They just didn't really have any gay friends.
And for their time period, yeah. That's probably what they witnessed
yes.
too.
Yeah. Exactly.
So they were being honest with what they felt.
True. And my father's a psychiatrist, and he was, you know, schooled in the early 70s, homosexuality and other sexuality or gender-based things were they were mental illnesses. And so the world in which they came from and the world in which they worked in was not, certainly not what it is today. But the moral of this parable is that I felt, you know, so much better, even though it was right. uncomfortable, even though it brought about a whole other thing. You know, it just was, the relief was so, I just always remember that. I even remember the chair. I sat down in this chair.
Wow.
And it was just like the world was different.
You have a specific visceral memory of it. Yeah. That's profound.
Yeah. And then other experiences of, you know, I've got to fix this without telling anybody. I got to make sure that this is my thing. And you lose control of it. And it's so scary and terrible. But then it turns out to be that's what needed to happen to move forward.
Your story kind of reminded me of this. One of my best friends who we reconnected after college. We were really good friends in high school. Kind of parted ways when college started, but then came back together. And I was just kind of re-brought back an image of him, and you could tell as he went to tell me that he was gay how he was not really embarrassed about it, but you could tell he didn't know how I was mm-hmm. going to react mm-hmm. and that there was this I don't want to say shame in who he was, but just the fact that he had never told me before mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. had the ability to come kind of talk to me about it mm-hmm. I can't say that I really knew, but I think the timing was good, because growing up in the 80s, you know that the 80s were not very...
No.
I mean, it was that point where I almost feel like, well, 70s probably even too, mm-hmm. where it was becoming more acceptable, but it was still a lot of pushback. And then as time has gone, I mean, this is completely heterosexual perspective, male saying... Things seem better to me, I know that it's still not all together, so.
Oh, my gosh. The gay festival in Old Town a few weeks ago.
It's just better than...
huge. Yeah. It was bigger than any of the other festivals, and it was
But anytime you're going to... anytime you're in that situation, you're always going to get pushback, so.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, Morgan, similar. You know, my experience was similar. I had that series of nightmares that I talked about, you know, in the first part of the show. Of being told, you can't be here. And that evaporated after I came out with my addictions. Mm. And once I started dealing with those and addressing those and doing what I needed to do and naming that and claiming it. But there is something about putting the light on it and talking to people about it and doing what you need to do to deal with it, to live the kind of lifestyle you need to live with that.
Yeah, I think that was the additional point, that you could see the relief in his eyes when he realized, oh, you are okay with this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, that's okay. Mm-hmm. He thought basically I would never want to talk to him mm-hmm. or be his friend again.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, yeah. No. Well, that's a part of that shaming perspective of I will be shunned. I am unacceptable. I'm going to be rejected. This is not going to be okay with mm-hmm. people. And with some people, it's not okay. Mm-hmm. Some people, it's, mm-hmm. you know, they struggle with that. But the idea of being able to cope with it by naming it and talking about it and finding people that are supportive of you is so important. And sometimes that happens in a therapeutic, hopefully it happens in a therapeutic context, but it also happens in friendships, mm-hmm. with family. And oftentimes people will experience like, okay, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. On the other hand, sometimes they find, oh, this is why I haven't talked right. about it, because you're going to act like this. Yeah, so.
Hmm. Yeah, and there are, going back to the coming out, I mean, there are not great coming out stories, but the, you know, moving forward with taking that off the table as far as like something that holds a person back. I mean, you know, I've also known people who lived closeted for most of their life and then came mm-hmm. out later in life. And that's a whole other experience, that finally they're able to live the life that they want to live, but also live without the shame of, or at least have taken away that burden of the shame.
Yeah, so an interesting point just comes up to me. The idea, like, you knew you were gay for a long time. I knew I had some kind of a substance use problem for a long time. When people don't know, if they experience shame but they don't know what it is, what do you think about that?
Hmm.
I mean, it usually will be manifesting in some way, some behavioral way, probably, that they're
I'm thinking about people, people with trauma, you know, trauma, and they may or may not remember. I mean, there is somewhat of a there's not a controversial idea about the psyche suppressing really bad mm-hmm. things that happen. The controversial thing I was thinking of was reclaimed memories and this that stuff that happened in kind of the 80s and the 90s.
That drives me crazy. I've had so many clients come to me and say, I know I was sexually abused, but I don't remember any of it. And it went on for a long time, and I don't remember any of it. Or I suddenly remember that I was sexually abused, and I'm like, yeah, I doubt that. I mean, that's going to be controversial mm-hmm. for some people, but that was a whole thing that there were a wave of therapists that were saying, if you don't remember it, that means it happened to you. And I just thought that was so destructive. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Well, what I was thinking was, you know, people who either have been through trauma, maybe, you know, remember it, it's very viscerally part of their life, but then act out in, mm-hmm. you know, ways that are not necessarily maybe they are reacting or reenacting the trauma, but acting out sexually or with drugs or risky behaviors, whatever that may be. And that's not uncommon, you know, mm-hmm. especially in adolescence and young adulthood and oftentimes fueled by substance use or what have you. But that's living, you know, and is it a choice? Is it not a choice? But living in a different lifestyle that, and sometimes it's, this is the way I want to live. This is who I am. This is mm-hmm. what I'm doing. This, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. Although from the outside looking in, is that a manifestation of shame? Is that a reappropriation, like taking control of experiences that happened? And then
the more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm thinking that if you start with someone's feelings their, you know, what's their emotional sense of themselves, there's that great book, The Body Keeps the Score, mm-hmm. that the body will store traumatic memory. And as you are able to talk about, Bessel van der Kolk is the author mm-hmm. of that. And when someone gets in touch with something, you know, often I will ask, where do you experience this in your body? And they'll be able to point right to it. And if you direct them to kind of take some deep breaths and talk about it, and what does it feel like, and are thoughts coming up? And when you do EMDR with a person, they can link that to specific kinds of memories. Now I'm getting this float back memory of this happening in my life or that happening in my life. It's usually something they do have a memory of that's connected mm-hmm. to that particular sensation, though.
I'm also thinking we should have a woman on this panel. Well, we are absent of a lady.
I wonder if
a woman's experience of shame. I mean, it's going to be totally different.
I would think so. And I think there are many women out there who have been saying this for about a year.
through season one.
That they should be.
Where's the woman? Where's the woman's perspective? And I agree. We need another microphone, though.
We can make it happen. Yeah. I can always step away, or we can add one in. So we're good.
We're taking...
Calling all women.
Calling all women. We're accepting applications. You have to have a mild background.
In psychotherapy.
And the human experience.
Or the human experience. You had to have lived a life and be willing to be mm-hmm. engaged in a lot of self-disclosure. Mm-hmm.
You know, with my clients, there's a lot of, again, I work with a lot of trans folks. So the gender progression, gender dysphoria, and then progressing through transition, you know, whatever that may mean for the person, mm-hmm. is a lot about moving through shame, kind of trying to navigate personal journey, what's best for them, who they are, versus the blowback that there's always, hopefully it's in a supportive mm-hmm. situation, but you know, there's cultural blowback, there's oftentimes family or really, you know, if they're in a relationship, marriage, sometimes children. It's both painful for them, and to be clear, that's usually therapeutically led, like with a therapist who specializes typically in gender progression. there's a lot of pain that goes with that. It's up and down, a lot based on circumstances, but there's a lot of power, or it's not necessarily joy because it can be not fun, but generally a positive, like a reclamation of self, a alleviation of shame, a, you know, feeling that they are becoming who they are, who they were meant to be.
As you say that, I think about a person building a context for themselves, you know, finding their tribe, basically, of finding other people. Whatever you have, other people have experienced it. If you name it, there's other people that are experiencing it. And if there are groups of people that would be able to connect and say, yep, that's the way I felt too. I had that happen to me. This is how I dealt with it. This is what works for me. This is what didn't work for me. And I mentioned, you know, for instance, Weight Watchers or people in recovery programs talk about how healing that is to sit in a group of people who have a similar dilemma and have had similar struggles. It helps them to both integrate that sense. And I think that is the eventual goal, is to integrate into yourself. This is a part of who I am. It's not the whole me, but it's a part of me. And it's part of me, how I felt about myself. It's part of my experiences. It's part of my trauma. And this is what I'm doing now to work with it and deal with it.
And it's so hard to do alone. You know, now I'm thinking of people with substance use disorder. A lot of times, you know, I'm seeing them and they're wanting to find out information. And I think I might have a drinking problem or what have you. And one of the recommendations is typically finding a community of folks who have been where they're at and are on the other side, whatever that looks like. But like, I would say probably 99.9% of the time, the person is like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to talk to anybody about this. I just want to fix it. I'm like, well, we're not going to be able to fix that right here, like here and now. Like, this is kind of like a whole thing that is going to be much larger than maybe what you're thinking. Yeah. But I can understand the fear that, I mean, it is shame. It's really shame. Yeah. I don't want anyone to know. I don't want to talk to other people about their, you know, but almost, I would say 99.9% of the time, as they move through that, if they do move through that, because that keeps people away from recovery for of whatever. The shame keeps people away. I mean, it keeps people in the situation that they're in the shame and in the pain.
And it's, this is controversial, but it's the way I feel about it, that the recovery movement, part of what their whole thing is, we have to remain anonymous, because if we're not anonymous, that means we're not being humble, and our humility is the most important thing. But absent of a lot of role models of people who are like, oh, all these people have these addictive issues and they got helped through going through a 12-step recovery program, I wonder how much that blocks people from entering, you know, that they don't have those really healthy role models. So in my wording, I say that I think sometimes the 12-step movement has unconsciously collaborated with the concept of shame by keeping themselves quiet, by keeping themselves silent, by keeping themselves hidden. I mean, it's simple enough to call and find out where a meeting is and you're accepted and all that kind of stuff. But just the idea that, no, we have to be unidentified. We have to remain anonymous.
But does that allow somebody who does feel shame about that to be able to walk in there and know that they're okay?
Certainly. Certainly. You can go in and not identify yourself as anything other than your first name. Mm-hmm. And I've known a number of people who've used different first names, even, you know, or they've gone to online meetings where they don't, you know, that they don't know anyone in the meeting. That's something.
Or
that
turn like the camera. I mean, you can be literally anonymous.
Right.
Some meetings that you have to have your camera on. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
It just depends on the situation, but.
Yeah, for sure. But anyway, but that basically, you know, what we're describing is the ability to name it, to get your feelings out about it, to be able to express it to somebody, to really integrate it into your sense of yourself.
And to connect. I mean, so I'm thinking of Brené Brown. I mean, you know, this is the realm of Brené Brown, which
it is.
I mean, she's amazing. I mean, I don't know if you've read her books, but she's incredibly inspiring, and she's well-traveled and kind of, she's I'm trying to remember. She's got a PhD. I mean, she's definitely a psych. You know, she's educated. She's practiced. She's now more in the, you know, kind of public speaking. Mm-hmm. But she did research, too, because a lot of her books, reference her research. But her work on shame and her discussion of shame is, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, she's...
And it's like we talked about in the first part of this, part of shame is a secret. That secrecy, I have a... This is a little off color, but I think I can say it here. When people sometimes wonder about the difference between what's a secret and what's private, I say, you know, everybody deserves privacy. Privacy is something you should have. You're entitled to privacy. You should be able to go into a bathroom and do whatever you need to do there, and no one, that's private. Mm-hmm. No one knows. If you go into the bathroom and you take a shit on the floor, that's a secret. That's a secret. That's something you feel shame about. Or a dump on the floor, if that'll be, will that get past the censors, Italian?
What are you talking about?
I'll take care of what needs to be taken
Quit
care of.
Quit taking a dump on the floor, Mike.
Mike's coming back, season two.
He's coming in blazing. Hot. He's coming in hot.
He's like, it's season two. I'm taking over. Not holding back at all.
Yeah. Anyway.
And point being is the secret is something that, well, isn't really a secret, but you do not want people knowing about it.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, your secret is not safe with me.
Whereas the privacy is something that we all should be respecting and that should be allowed for any and everybody.
If it harms yourself or others, then it crosses the line from privacy into secrecy into something that is shaming or shameful.
I have a niece who's 6 and my nephew is 10, and you know, as they were potty trained, there was a change. There was, you know, you change their diapers, you're all in there and everything's fine. They're running around naked. And then one day they're like, "This is private." And you're like, "Oh, is it?" Something has changed, which you respect. I mean, you know, it is a part of the process. I remember I'm a nurse, you know, so I'm like, well, are we like doing what we need to do? And are we washing our hands? And are we cleaning correctly? And so, yes, it's private, but I'd like to know what exactly is happening in there.
Right.
But, you know, you got to let it go and let them do their thing.
Have we exhausted that?
Have we run the course?
At some point, we, you know, as kids.
All right, recap ways to address it one more time.
Talking about it, you know, the shame tells you don't tell anybody. Nobody should know. Nobody wants to know. And the answer is usually to do the opposite of what that is.
And find your people. A Psychodelicious Conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google therapy or therapists in your area, check with community mental health, or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike and Morgan welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send us an email at apsychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com. That is apsychodelicious, psychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton and Morgan Bowen, and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.